Welcome to Vine Abiders, a Bible study with me, Chris White, live streamed on YouTube and Facebook every other Wednesday night at 7 p.m. Eastern. You can also search for the term Vine Abiders on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or our home base at Substack. So this week we are moving right along in Matthew 5, the Sermon on the Mount, and we come to verses 33 through 37, which are about vows and oaths. It says, "Again, you have heard that the ancients were told, 'You shall not make false vows, but shall fulfill your vows to the Lord.' But I say to you, make no oath at all, either by heaven, for it is the throne of God, or by the earth, for it is the footstool of his feet, or by Jerusalem, for it is the city of the great king. Nor shall you make an oath by your head, for you cannot make one hair white or black. But let your statement be yes, yes, or no, no. Anything beyond these is evil." All right, so we're going to talk about oaths and vows. And clearly here in Matthew 5, Jesus is saying not to make oaths at all. We'll see later in James that he says in the strongest possible terms, above all, don't make oaths. So it's a prohibition. It's certainly not something I had really heard taught on before. And so it was an interesting study, and we'll just jump right in. So what is an oath? So oaths are different than vows. We'll get to vows in a minute, but they are kind of lumped together here in this statement of Jesus in Matthew 5 and other places. So an oath I like to think of as something that you're doing to prove that you're going to tell the truth or be faithful. And so, for example, if you are on the witness stand at a court, you're supposed to raise your right hand and say, "I solemnly swear to tell the truth, the whole truth, so help me God." There's at least three things in that moment that are typical of oaths. The first is invoking God or something sacred is probably the most key part, because what the idea is that you're sort of borrowing God's holiness and faithfulness to attest to your truthfulness. So you're sort of like taking on loan his awesomeness to prove that you're going to tell the truth in this instance. And also the raising of the hand, sacred gestures are a big part of it. Raising the right hand, placing the hand on the Bible, crossing your heart, ritual actions, putting your hand to your throat, you're calling on a deity, you're making a sacred gesture. And usually it's a formal phrase too, like "I swear," "I pledge." There's a lot of self-cursing language, saying things like, "If I don't keep this, may X happen to me." So really, oaths are to tell other people that you're going to be acting faithfully and truthfully. And I think of it like, you know, when I was a kid, we used to say, "I swear to God," you know, to other kids about virtually everything. But we would use that phrase whenever we wanted to tell the other kid, "Hey, I really did see this," or "I really did this. I'm not lying to you." And, you know, swearing to God was like, "Oh, well, I guess he's really not lying to me." That was how you could prove to it. So an oath, and I think that's also a similar idea with oaths of office for people who are, you know, swearing in to be a president or a congressman or something like that. They're also, you know, trying to prove to everybody that they're going to be faithful in their job. So it's similar in the idea of taking an oath is proving to other people that you're going to be truthful and honest. A vow, on the other hand, is a little different. It is a solemn promise of commitment or dedication. It's either directed to God or made before God. So in wedding ceremonies, we gather here in the presence of God. That's the idea of we're about to make a vow or a commitment. And we see these in the Bible too, the Nazirite vow, where they would cut their hair. The Nazirite vow is often associated with purity. It's interesting. I don't know that I understand it 100%. I don't know that it's explained 100%, but that's another story. But it is often tied to sacrifice, devotion, or lifelong commitments. Breaking it is super serious. I mean, when you see people taking a vow in the Old or New Testaments, it's just the most serious thing. Like, the idea of breaking that vow is just not even an option. It's not something that they can even consider. And so vows are in the same sense, very, very serious. But a key difference is that an oath is you're calling on God to guarantee or provide surety to the truthfulness of your word to others. And a vow is more of a dedication to bind yourself in God's sight. It doesn't have to be when spoken to other people, but it can be. As I said, that vows are not expressly prohibited where oaths are. And one way to show that vows aren't prohibited is that in the book of Acts, there are at least two instances where vows are in play from the Christians in the church. Acts 18:18, which says, "And Paul, after this, tarried there a good while, and then took his leave of the brethren and sailed thence to Syria, and with him Priscilla and Aquila, having shorn his head in Cyrenaica, for he had a vow. And there are some that question whether it was Paul or somebody that was with him made a vow, but I think that the general idea is that it was Paul. Also, there's a somewhat strange instance in Acts 21:23-24, when it says, "We have four men which have a vow on them, take them and purify themselves with them, that they may shave their heads and all may know that those things are true." It goes on a little bit more. Those just sort of paraphrase there, but there's four men and Paul's supposed to pay their way and sort of join in their purification rituals, probably a Nazarite vow. But the point is that the early church seems to have been endorsing this vow of these four men and taking it super seriously. Again, the idea was like, no chance whatsoever are you going to break the vow. So the New Testament records vows being taken, unlike oaths, which Jesus and James explicitly discourage. Vows are not forbidden. However, they are to be viewed as solemn commitments made before God, not taken casually or rashly. I would suggest, as I'll say later, it's probably best to use Jesus's points on vows and oaths, since they're often together. Take the advice of him, is better not to make them at all. You know, just let your yes be yes and your no be no. Don't put yourself in that situation, because as we'll see, God takes this very, very seriously. So let's take this passage in Matthew 5 a piece at a time, and starting off with this first part where he says, "Again, you have heard that the ancients were told, 'You shall not make false vows, but shall fulfill your vows to the Lord.'" So the pattern that Jesus is saying here is what he's been doing before, which is calling back, saying, "You've heard that you shouldn't commit murder," and he's usually, you know, talking about some Old Testament law. He's like, "But I say you shouldn't be angry." And it's the same pattern he's doing here. He's pointing to something in the Old Testament that you shall not make false vows, but you shall fulfill your vows to the Lord. So that's the law he's going to now amplify and say, "I say to you, make no oath at all." So let's first look at what the Old Testament says about oaths. And here are three interesting passages. The first in Numbers 30, verse 2. "If a man makes a vow to the Lord, or takes an oath to bind himself with a binding obligation, he shall not violate his word. He shall do according to all that proceeds out of his mouth." Okay, so that's pretty straightforward. If you make an oath, you've got to do it. Deuteronomy 23:21-23 says, "When you make a vow to the Lord your God, you shall not delay to pay it, for it would be a sin to you, and the Lord your God will surely require it of you. However, if you refrain from vowing, it would not be a sin in you. You shall be careful to perform what goes out from your lips, just as you have voluntarily vowed to the Lord your God what you have promised." It's pretty straightforward, but an interesting thing here is, "and the Lord your God shall surely require it of you." So this is a little bit of the why are we being serious about this? Because God will surely require it from you. Ecclesiastes 5:4-5 says, "When you make a vow to God, do not be late in paying it, for he takes no delight in fools. Pay what you vow. It is better that you should not vow than you should vow and not pay." Here's an interesting one that I did not even think about before doing this study, but in the Ten Commandments, in Exodus 20:7, taking the Lord's name in vain is certainly believed by, you know, a lot of scholars and certainly Jewish people and stuff, that that's referring to making a false oath. In other words, taking the Lord's name is in vain is saying, "I swear by the Lord or the temple or whatever else that I am telling the truth," and then you're not telling the truth or you break that oath. that is taking the Lord's name in vain. And there's lots of ways that you can kind of make that claim. Leviticus 19:12 says, "You shall not swear falsely by my name so as to profane the name of your God. I am the Lord." But I've got these other instances in the Bible where the word vain is just translated straight up as false. Exodus 23:1 says, "Thou shalt not raise a false," that's that same word, shav, report. "Thou shalt not raise a false report." Deuteronomy 5:20, "Neither shalt thou bear false witness against thy neighbor." So false there is that same word as vain. I should say that the word vain can be just vain. So it can be about profanity or taking the Lord's name in an idle way. I don't think that that's an exclusive situation. And I've got here some quotes from Jewish scholars, quote, "The prohibition is concerned not with profanity, but with perjury. To invoke the divine name in support of a false oath is to besmirch the name with deceit." So again, it's not the entire meaning of taking the Lord's name in vain, but it's certainly maybe even the primary way that you take the Lord's name in vain is to make an oath and then not fulfill that oath. So earlier we heard that, you know, God will surely make you pay, or he will not hold you guiltless if you break an oath. And there's some really interesting instances of this in the Old Testament. For example, Saul with the Gibeonites, Joshua 9, 2 Samuel 21, 1 through 2. So this is interesting because Israel swore an oath not to harm the Gibeonites. So these are like not Israelites. These are the Gibeonites, and Israel swore an oath to them not to harm them. And then hundreds of years later, Saul broke that covenant and tried to kill the Gibeonites. As punishment for this, God brought a famine on Israel until restitution was made. This is like the other one we're going to look at, where the oath was actually made to non-Israelites, but God punished Israel because of that oath. So look at this one in Ezekiel 17:11 through 21 and 2 Chronicles 36 through 13. This is Zedekiah's oath to Babylon. King Zedekiah, an Israelite king, swore an oath of loyalty to Nebuchadnezzar. So this is after Nebuchadnezzar conquers Israel, right? So he takes all the Israelites back to Babylon, but Nebuchadnezzar sets up King Zedekiah as sort of the king of Israel, that what's left of Israel, basically. So you get to be king of this. And King Zedekiah swore an oath of loyalty to Nebuchadnezzar, as one would do if one is a conquered king and you get set up as a vassal. So he swears his oath in God's name, but then he breaks it when a rebellion starts to spring up, Egypt and so on. Zedekiah joins that rebellion against Nebuchadnezzar, the conqueror of Israel. And God declared that breaking that oath was a sin against God, against him. And Zedekiah was judged, and his kingdom was destroyed, and he was taken captive. So he was certainly held accountable to what we would think of as, oh, surely, I mean, he swore the oath to Babylon. It's not even that big of a deal. I mean, Babylon's obviously wrong, so it doesn't matter. But these two instances, which are some really important instances, show that that's just not true. Both of these we would look at as like Nebuchadnezzar is a bad guy. He's creating, this statue of himself and telling people to worship it. Surely God isn't like going to hold you accountable to an oath to that guy. And yet that's exactly what this story says. All right, moving on to the next part of this passage in Matthew 5. So Jesus says, "You've heard that the ancients were told, 'You shall not make false vows, but you shall fulfill your vows to the Lord.'" Then he says, "But I say to you, make no oath at all." So this is a pretty clear commandment from Jesus to not make any oaths at all. And then we have James in James 5 echoing this teaching from Jesus. "But above all, my brethren, do not swear, either by heaven or by earth or with any other oath, but your yes is to be yes and your no, no, so that you may not fall under judgment." So there's a few interesting things here. The first is this "but above all." So he really emphasizes the importance of not swearing oaths. It's possible that this is broadly James's teaching about the sins of the mouth. So this is in the general section where he talks about the different things that your tongue can do. It's a little member, but it can cause a lot of damage. So this may be the biggest damage that your tongue can do. Although it's really in context, it's just a bunch of different teachings about general Christian life that he's saying. So I'm not sure if he's saying, but above all, in terms of the things in Christian life, don't swear oaths, or he's saying, but above all, within the context of things your tongue can do, don't swear oaths. But in any case, the idea is this is a very serious thing, according to James, that Christians should know. And the other interesting thing here is that he ends that with, why should you not swear oaths, but let your yes be yes and your no, no, so that you may not fall under judgment? So in my opinion, by James saying this, this puts this squarely in the lap of the Christian. We've got to deal with this as something Christians need to deal with. And this idea that so you may not fall under judgment is really interesting. It may be that he's obviously talking about what Jesus said here when Jesus in Matthew 5 in the Sermon on the Mount says it. And Jesus ends that with, so that anything beyond these is evil. So obviously something to be evil would be judged. That's very harsh language. But James is probably also, in my opinion, referring to the breaking of the oaths in the Old Testament, especially as we talked about before, the idea that Exodus 20 verse 7, the taking of the Lord's name in vain, probably is at least primarily about making an oath but not fulfilling it. And I want to read the part that's not usually read in that commandment. Exodus 20, verse 7, "Thou shalt not take the name of the Lord thy God in vain, for the Lord will not hold him guiltless that taketh his name in vain." So this is kind of what they say, a commandment with promise. You know, don't take the Lord's name in vain, because the Lord will not hold him guiltless that takes his name in vain. So that may be what James is saying here when he says that, so that you may not fall under judgment. And is he saying that don't swear either by heaven or earth with an oath, but let your yes be yes and your no, no, so that you may not fall under judgment? Is he saying if you make an oath at all that you're going to fall under judgment? I mean, you could read it like that. But I think what he's saying here is the same basic point that Jesus is making, is that don't make an oath at all, because you don't know what's going to happen. You might not fulfill that oath. And then, you know, that Exodus 20 verse 7, God won't hold you guiltless for that. I've got here some quotes from the early church about oaths. I think it's generally taken for granted that the early church, as they did with pretty much everything that Jesus said, took it ultra seriously, took it at face value. If Jesus said not to do it, they believed that that was instruction for Christians. And so that seems to be the nature of these quotes that I'm reading. I would say there is some ambiguity in some of the quotes where it sounds like maybe they did allow some oaths like they would vows, but it had to be super, super serious and made sure that you fulfilled it. But for the most part, it's a pretty blanket prohibition of oaths. So here is Origen. He says, "There are commandments contained in the gospel that allow no doubt whether they are to be observed according to the letter or not. For example, but I say unto you, swear not at all." So Origen is saying this prohibition against swearing oaths is one of those occasions where there's no doubt whether it's to be observed according to the letter. We got Clement of Alexandria writing about 195. "The man of proved character in such piety is far from being apt to lie and to swear, for an oath is a divisive affirmation with the taking of the divine name. For how can he that is once faithful show himself unfaithful so as to require an oath, and so that his life may not be a sure and decisive oath? He lives and walks and shows the trustworthiness of his affirmation in an unwavering and sure life and speech." Tertullian, 198, "Of perjury I am silent, even swearing is not lawful." So he basically just says straight up, swearing is not lawful, and so he's not going to be guilty of perjury because he doesn't swear. Cyprian, 250, "You are compelled to swear, which is not lawful." Moving on to this other part of Matthew 5, 33 through 37, it says, "But I say to you, make no oath at all, either by heaven, for it is the throne of God, or by the earth, for it is the footstool of his feet, or by Jerusalem, for it is the city of the great king, nor shall you make an oath by your head, for you cannot make one hair white or black. For let your statement be yes, yes, or no, anything beyond these is evil. So what is Jesus talking about here with the temple and different things? I think it's explained a little bit later on in the book of Matthew, in Matthew 23:16 through 22, in his exchange with the Pharisees, who had certain traditions about swearing oaths and what you could and couldn't swear oaths upon. And it says this: "Woe to you, blind guides, who say, 'Whoever swears by the temple, that is nothing, but whoever swears by the gold of the temple is obligated.' You fools and blind men, which is more important, the gold or the temple that sanctified the gold? And you say, 'Whoever swears by the altar, that is nothing, but whoever swears by the offering that is on it, he is obligated.' You blind men, which is more important, the offering or the altar that sanctifies the offering? Therefore, the one who swears by the altar swears by both the altar and everything on it. And the one who swears by the temple swears by both the temple and by him who dwells in it. And the one who swears by heaven swears by both the throne of God and by him who sits upon it." So the idea was that there was this tradition that had developed, but that you could swear by the temple and it wouldn't be binding if you didn't end up fulfilling the oath, but if you swear by the gold of the temple. And we tend to think that this teaching is just about, okay, well, Jesus was correcting this silly legalism of the Pharisees. And of course, in one way, he is doing that. But if you look at this broadly, what he's teaching is that he's basically sweeping all the details aside. You know, they had sort of created these legal loopholes with this, swear by this, but not that, and it's not binding and all that stuff. Jesus basically says, if you are even attempting to make an oath and bring me into it as surety, whether that's by the temple or by heaven, or you're trying to be cute and not invoke me specifically, but if you're sort of even tangentially involving me in your oaths, then it is binding. I mean, that's the real teaching of this, is that oaths are binding and taken seriously by God. So one question is, why does God care so deeply about oaths? And on the one hand, you could say that an oath borrows God's reputation to guarantee or give surety for human words. And so breaking that oath drags God's name into that falsehood. So that could be one reason why you say God cares deeply about oaths. That's why he will hold you accountable if you break them. And I would say that's obvious, but it also is something about this is not quite obvious. And I don't really know the answer. I'm certain that there's a good reason. The fact that we are not to take oaths is pretty clear. The exact nature of why not isn't. There is a bit of a hint, I think, although I'm not sure it's the exact same thing, but it's part of Jesus's reasoning and then James's as well, as he's obviously taking this from Jesus, about this idea of let your yes be yes and your no, no. So in some sense, Jesus is raising the bar for Christians about truth in all speech. Integrity should be so consistent among Christians that swearing is unnecessary. For example, here are some speech integrity passages in the New Testament. Ephesians 4:25. "Therefore, laying aside falsehood, speak truth, each one of you with his neighbor, because we are parts of one another." Colossians 3:9. "Do not lie to one another, since you stripped off the old self with its evil practices." So lying to one another is an evil practice. Christians have stripped it off. It's not even to be named among Christians. It's part of our old self. 1 Peter 3:10, quoting Psalms 34, "For the one who wants to love life and see good days must keep his tongue from evil and his lips from speaking deceit." So remembering that oaths are mostly there to prove to other people that you're telling the truth. I solemnly swear I'm telling the whole truth and nothing but the truth, so help me God. That's the general idea. You're trying to prove to other people that you're not about to lie. And so Christians don't need to do that. And I think that their argument against people, which, you know, beyond saying, look, I can't swear this oath, it says right here, above all, Christians don't swear oaths, so I'm not going to swear oath because that's what this says. But in doing that, I think it really does show that, hey, look, this guy is a person who takes being honest super seriously. Like he's going to obey the Bible to the letter. And in that it's own surety. You know, they believe that you're going to tell the truth and accomplish what an oath otherwise would, which is I raise my hand and cross my heart and hope to die, that I'm totally going to tell you the truth right now. So you don't have to do that if you're the kind of person who just will go the extra mile. And let's talk about what going the extra mile looks like in our world, because there are a lot of oaths out there. Here are a few that you're likely to encounter in America. I mentioned the courtroom oath and jury oaths. So if you're going to be a witness on the stand, you have to raise your right hand. Juries have to do the same thing if you're going to be a part of a jury. Military oaths of enlistment, military officer oaths. If you're going to become a citizen of a country, you've got to do an oath of allegiance to get that citizenship. And then marriage vows are not oaths, but I do have them here because they typically can often invoke and do a lot of the same things. And so we'll talk about that in a minute. The first thing I'll say is that if you have been convicted about this and you're thinking to yourself, okay, I'm not going to take oaths anymore, you should know that the places that you have to take oaths, generally speaking, they offer an alternative to taking an oath. They are aware that different religions take Jesus's words very seriously in Matthew 5 and other places, Quakers, Mennonites, you know, the Amish and that kind of stuff. Other sort of fringier groups like Jehovah's Witnesses don't. So they're used to people saying, I don't take oaths. And so they offer an alternative. Usually this is in the form of an affirmation. I affirm that I will tell the truth. But just saying the word affirm instead of swear is not necessarily all that you'll have to do. I mean, if they're saying at the end of it, so help me God, well, you're doing the thing that you can't do, which is bring God's name into this as surety that you're going to tell the truth. So you can't bring God into it at all. Saying affirm instead of swear is certainly important. I even wouldn't raise my hand. I would go through all this if I had to with somebody to say, look, can I see the text of this oath that you're going to want me to say? It's like, I can't do that. I can't do that. I won't do that. And this is why. As I said, they have this set up. They know people are crazy like this, so they should be able to accommodate it. And if they don't, if they say, look, you've got to raise your hand in this situation and do this, or put your hand in the Bible, and you say, I don't, I won't, and they what, throw you in jail? I don't know what they'll do. But you've got to be okay with doing that, I think. I don't know. I mean, this is all up to, you know, your own convictions and things like that. So some others are military oaths and enrollment in military officer oaths. I would say, you know, this is actually one of the reasons, besides the sort of nonviolence. I mean, the early church took it very seriously. Other things that Jesus said too, which is to love your enemies. And so to them, that meant not killing your enemies. And so they wouldn't join the military. But the other reason why is because of these oaths. And I'd say if you're interested in the sort of nonviolence idea of it, and see a YouTube video called What If Jesus Meant Every Word That He Said? And it's an interesting sort of take on this from people that were in the military and their sort of journey for taking Jesus's word seriously with regard to nonviolence. I'm not 100% sure what I know about all that yet. I haven't really got there yet. I'm sort of learning this as I go too. But that is an interesting video if you're interested in it. But certainly, I would say if you are in the military or thinking about being in the military, I would definitely check that out, because I would say with regard to military oaths, there's other more important problems than just the oath there. But certainly, I bet they would have a alternative that you could say there as well. But as I said, I think there are bigger problems with military issues. I have briefly looked into this for citizenship requirements. So there are different ways to get second citizenships and stuff. And it seems, at least the few that I've looked into, so for example, one of the citizenship by investment places in St. Kitts and Nevis, they explicitly don't require oaths at all. I think it's one of the few, they say it on their website, hey, unlike others, we don't even require an oath. So they know that it's important for some people to not require an oath. Most citizenship programs, whether that's by residence or whatever, they do require an oath, but my digging around a little bit shows that they do offer an affirm option out of that. And again, it would be something you would need to talk to somebody about and make sure that that would be okay before going through that whole process. Let's talk about marriage vows, because I think this is one that is nuanced and important to talk about. I think my position on vows is that they're spoken of in the same breath as oaths. As I said, they're not prohibited, but they are to be taken seriously. But the basic teaching is it's better to avoid vows whenever possible, because the same requirement to fulfill them is there. But the marriage vows are interesting, especially in modern day. The Bible doesn't say that you need to do what we do with marriage ceremony. In fact, most of what we do in marriage ceremonies are just totally extra biblical. I did a marriage ceremony once. I am a ordained a minister, and I was, you know, looking at the laws and regulations of what states require. And it's really very, very minimal of like, basically do you, okay, that's all. I mean, that's all that's really required is getting somebody to say, I want to be married. I also want to be married. I mean, it might not even be that much, but I was surprised at how minimal was required, at least to be married. As far as biblically required, there's also nothing there. It's also a joke that, you know, the pastors sort of open the Bible vaguely to the middle when they are saying, dearly beloved, which is not in the Bible. We are gathered here today, not in the Bible, before God, not in the Bible. All that stuff is extra biblical tradition. I would say that marriage is spoken of as a covenant. It doesn't give a whole lot of details about that. Malachi 2:14 says, the Lord has been a witness between you and the wife of your youth. Probably the idea that in a marriage, it's okay to say, you know, we're gathered here before God, that God is a witness to this covenant. But that should show you how serious it is. We talked about divorce and remarriage last week. So a covenant is there, but a lot of what we do with vows in modern wedding ceremonies to me are just like dangerous nonsense. Like if we're just going to, now it's time for the exchanging of vows. I vow to do this. Like it's better not to do that part of the ceremony. Like just skip it. Like there's no reason to just enter into that much danger because you may mean all that stuff, but you might forget it and you might break it. And that brings us to sort of the heart of this, which is, what do I do if I have broken vows in the past that I know that I have? Am I going to hell? What is the issue here? And I would say, like everything else that we have done in the past, there is forgiveness. We confess and we ask for forgiveness. We're to ask for forgiveness every day in the Lord's Prayer. And certainly, I do think that there is mercy, and every case of this is different. But if, you know, you made a vow that is something that is not sinful and that you could potentially keep still, then you need to keep it. I don't know. It's a difficult question, because sometimes we make vows that are, you know, in the flippant way that we do it, that are based on sinful things. And so would I say to keep a sinful vow? I mean, it really, you know, it's convicting because of those passages we looked at earlier where the Israelite king made a vow to Nebuchadnezzar and God held him accountable, despite Nebuchadnezzar, by all accounts, not being a good guy. Although I would say Nebuchadnezzar might have been a good guy towards the end, but it's a difficult thing to say. Nevertheless, I don't think that's the point. The point is that vows are vows. And yet, I am going against what I said also last week, which was that, you know, John Piper's argument for why it's okay to stay in a remarriage, despite John Piper also saying that remarriage after divorce is adultery. He says, well, you don't want to get divorced that time because then it would be breaking a vow, and so you can't break vows. And so I would say my argument at that point was like, would John Piper say that about homosexual marriage? Well, you got to stay in your homosexual marriage because you made a vow. So I think that it is a case-by-case basis, and I do think that there's mercy. But I also think that, like everything, once you know, a lot of this stuff that we're talking about here is stuff like, for me, that, look, I've never heard a sermon on oaths or vows in my entire life. It's just not something that I knew about. And certainly going forward, I do feel that I am going to be held accountable. If I make an oath from now on or a vow from now on, well, I mean, I think that I'm going to be held accountable. I don't know what judgment looks like in that case. I mean, in the Old Testament, you know, the king of Israel, you know, there were famines and they lost their kingdom and they were taken captive and eventually killed or something like that. Does that mean he went to hell because of it? I mean, I don't know. I don't think so. I hope not. Like so many things, I hope that there is mercy in that. But I do know that this is a very strong commandment. And now that my eyes have been opened, the knowledge of good and evil here, I do believe that I am accountable for that. And so regardless of what I may have done flippantly when I was a kid, when I said, I swear to God here, you know, I don't know that I need to, I probably need to sit down and ask for forgiveness for all that stuff. And I do think that there is forgiveness for all that stuff. So it is a case by case basis. Like so much of this stuff, you need to get serious about it with God in prayer. And I think that will do it for this week. So thank you for listening to Vine Abiders with me, Chris White, live every Wednesday at 7 p.m. We're going to start probably doing this on shortwave radio at 7 p.m., but the live stream on YouTube and Facebook will be every other Wednesday at 7 p.m. Eastern Time in the United States, as well as the audio podcast, which you can get at Apple Podcasts. Just go to search for Vine Abiders there, or on Spotify, or on Substack, Vine Abiders, where you can subscribe to get email updates when we go live and when I publish blog posts, etc. All right, thank you for your time, and we'll see you next time. Bye.